outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gen.
Well, Kyle, did you take in that celebration of masculinity from the White House this weekend?
I did not.
The fact that somebody called it a celebration of masculinity and guys just love to fight. And I thought, boy, we sure wasted the last 2 weeks, I guess, when we talk about patriarchy, because there's so many people that see white supremacy and white masculine supremacy as just the way it should be. And it just makes my heart so sad.
Yeah, that was I thought a lot about our conversations that we had had with Joni over the last couple of weeks as I was even watching the pictures of them preparing for the event. And I'm like, really? Like, what? The whole thing just kind of made my stomach turn a little bit, honestly.
Well, to each their own. If some people like martial arts, fighting or golf or whatever. But man, when you call that the celebration of masculinity, that's what kind of does my heart in.
When you pigeonhole it into a certain space that has unfortunately been very negatively associated in the past. I have trained in MMA in the past and loved it and loved the camaraderie that happens there. I'm also starting to learn how to golf and other things. And so it's like there's so much complexity and texture to what healthy masculinity is in today's world that.
And some of the commentary I heard was men who are so tired of being forced into being sensitive roles. They just, good man needs to get out and fight sometimes and do something around. I'm going, okay, not the world I grew up in and not my association with masculinity at all. But in any case, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And we're alone today for this episode of the podcast.
We are.
Third voice here. I was on a podcast today with three voices because Toby and I did a podcast for somebody on the theme of the book. And so cool. A lot of fun with that. Got the retreat coming together in Kansas City. We got, we're almost topping out now at the number of people that we had room for. It seems like just a wonderful group of people that are going to have fun just being together, much less exploring some themes in a book that Toby and I are part of. I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, what better way to explore the themes, right? Like to have that setting of people who will just genuinely enjoy one another's presence. And then you get a very heartfelt, spirited conversation that is being catalyzed as a result of, a shared topic. That's a great space to be.
Yeah, it is. Well, best thing you heard this week. We haven't done it for a couple of weeks. So
we haven't.
Have you got some you're banking in the bank?
And we might talk about this later in the podcast, but Jess and I had a staycation over the last 4 days. We didn't have any kiddos and we were just here in Sheridan enjoying time together. And it was such a wonderful heart recharge. But in the midst of that, there was a false identity statement that kind of came up when in the midst of my staycation and some reflection and journaling and stuff that was happening during that time. And I shared that false identity statement and it had to do with me being irresponsible.
Which no one was accusing you of, but just the statement that lives below the surface in your own psyche.
All the time. Yeah, the core identity statement, false identity statement was, you're an irresponsible son. And there's a lot of implications and a lot of ways that that has spiderwebbed itself into my world and into my life. And so Jess and I were just processing it in one of the afternoons that we were together and just on a walk. And she pauses and she looks at me and she said, I hope you know that I trust my heart and the lives of my daughters with you because you're one of the most responsible people I've ever met. And that was like such a beautiful moment of Jess affirming my heart, moving in the opposite direction of that false identity and her just saying, no, that's not true. I'm going to call that out for what it is. And I want you to know where my heart stands. And it was just a very kind, very loving moment to recalibrate some of that false identity shame stuff. It was a very corrective moment.
Yeah, it's funny what you don't see in people, because I look at you as being incredibly responsible. I mean, the program you're leading at the college, the how you're raising your daughters and your and the love for your wife and all that she's gone through. And I wouldn't even put irresponsibility in the same world with the Kyle Rice I know. And yet somebody can be struggling with something that would seem absolutely impossible, even to a close friend who would go, really? You wrestle with that? And knowing what some of what Sarah wrestles with inside her trauma as well, I just go, it's strange that that can live there when the life of the person is such the opposite. Yeah. And it's also, as we've talked about before, Jess can give you a great statement about it, whatever. Does that totally disarm what 39 years have you been living with, you know? It'd be nice if it could. It'd be nice if one positive thing could undermine all the negative that got started there, particularly at young ages, particularly you don't even live there anymore. But
correct.
Wow.
But no, it was just there was a lot of spiritual warfare stuff that was happening around that. And I mean, it was at the time, it was very, very raw and just like sorting out the pieces of where it was going. And so to have her like pause the conversation and to say, beautiful. Hey, I need you to know this from my perspective.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful. What about you?
That's more the Kyle I know. I've got a whole bunch of wonderful things stacking up on my whatever, but I think I'll pick this one out for today because I've never heard this statement before. It seems so obvious. And I'm thinking, well, somebody must have said that and I've just missed it. And I tried to Google it and chat GPT it and I didn't find it being said anywhere. But a lady named Esther wrote me and she said, when I first wrote you about a year ago, I told you I'd been in a deep depression where I would dread going to sleep and would dread waking up in the morning. Now when I go to bed, I look forward to hearing from Father in my dreams. And when I wake up in the morning, I look forward to the adventure with the Trinity, which is what a different way to change living. But part of that, what she said is, I've come to realize my emotions are a messenger, not a master.
Oh, gosh. Ooh, hold on. I got to write that down. My emotions are a messenger, not a master.
Yeah, which is so perfect because you deal with people who just live by their feelings all the time and their lives get messed up. And then you got people who just ignore your feelings, just do whatever you've got in your mind and head. To me, this statement is a perfect understanding. It's not dismissive of feelings. It recognizes they're a messenger. They may not be accurate, but they're telling you something.
Yes.
And then, but they're not your master. That I'm not going to live by that just because I feel a certain way. And I thought it was breathtakingly beautiful that it encompasses all of that in just a very simple statement. I thought surely somebody else has said this. And if they have, I couldn't find it.
My emotions are a messenger, not a master. Wow. That is, man, I love that so much.
I do too. Because you can, when you have feeling, you can sit down with Jesus and process the feeling.
Yes.
Not ignore it. Just say, hold it a minute. I'm feeling in despair.
Yeah.
Should I? Is there something going on that warrants this? Well, maybe going through some difficult times, but Jesus is bigger than this. So I can work my way through my feelings if I can honor them as a messenger. They're bringing me information that may be based on something true. They may be based on something false. But if I don't have the courage to process them, especially with Jesus, I'm not going to learn anything by him.
Yeah, Jesus and trusted community. I mean, that's, like as I'm looking at the statement and as we're processing this, that's literally how I got to that core false identity statement. Was I was feeling shame because I went out and rode on a motorcycle with a friend of mine. He and I went and rode motorcycles together, and I got back and I just got hit with shame and guilt. And so I took those emotions and presented them to a good friend of mine who knows me very, very well and said, I don't know what to do with this. Like, I don't know where these emotions are coming from, but they were the messenger that revealed something that God's been uprooting and bringing to the surface for I don't even know how long. He's been working on it for a minute. And that was so cool because that's how we were able to drill down into it. Beautiful. Instead of it becoming the master, like that shame, those shame gremlins, as Brené Brown calls them, allowing them to be the master of that situation, it was like, okay, what's being highlighted here? Because this feels irrational. This doesn't feel like it's in alignment with the situation that I just got done with. And so like, what, I need some feedback here. Like, Holy Spirit, what's going on? And community, what's going on here?
That's great. Hey, let's jump into the old mailbag if we could.
Yeah.
I don't know if you get any good email. I've got quite a bit from our patriarchy two-parter with Joni. And again, Joni, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. This came from Ron. It says, thank you for the two-part episode with Kyle and Joni. Patriarchy has been has had a profound impact on my family of origin, and 12 years from my father's death still affects me acutely. My father was the primary abuser in my family of a sexual nature. I've paid a horrible price physically, emotionally, and financially. Without the presence of Jesus in my life, I'm afraid worse things would have happened to me. Through these two podcasts, and also through the trauma podcast with Sarah, you have become an avenue for me to express what I have needed to express for a long time, but didn't know how. I thank you immensely for that. The combination of your pastoral knowledge and transparency, I'm sure, has been a saving grace for many, including myself.
Wow.
Isn't that good? It's worth talking about, worth disarming. And this from someone, I'm going to withhold the name, but somebody wrote me and just said, but recently I realized I can get healthy by myself, but can't control what my spouse does. Speaking about getting some stuff from her husband that's been hurtful to herself and her two daughters, as a matter of fact. And he said, unfortunately, my daughters have not known. This was a statement at the end of the letter that I kind of wanted to highlight. Unfortunately, my daughters have not known any men who are Christ-like, but have met men who try to manipulate them with Christianity.
Ooh, that is heartbreaking. That guts you.
It is heartbreaking, but I also thought it was very insightful to realize the difference. Just because somebody's using Christian language doesn't mean they're honorable men who are Christ-like. You can use Christianity to manipulate people. Oh, and absolutely. Many people do. Not just leaders, sometimes boys on dates are using it to manipulate girls, but to just say, I've not known any men who are Christ-like, but many who try to manipulate them with Christianity. Gosh.
Yeah, I've had a couple of interesting conversations, even just in this last semester, about with students. I mean, they get to know me, they trust me, and then especially it's the start of class and the end of class that all of a sudden we tend to launch into these more personal spaces of what's going on in their world and what they're processing. And I had two different students in one semester say that they had the God card pulled on them in dating situations and felt so used and manipulated and felt like the person was not taking any kind of responsibility or authority over their own actions, that they were just using using Christianity and Christianese language to shirk responsibility and to get out of situations that they didn't like. And it was some very interesting dialogue to hear from these ladies' perspective.
Wow, man, that happens more than we know, unfortunately. And usually when it does happen, do the people who are watching it happen or the victim of it, there's a very yucky feeling inside.
Yeah.
And yet they're using scripture or they're saying something that, you know, like even people say, we should pray about that and start praying in a way that's not necessarily leaning into what Jesus might want to do, but just trying to bury the discomfort of the circumstance in some kind of religious language. And it's always hard to call it out, even to yourself, because you feel like, oh, boy, you know, yeah, we should. And this is how easily we get manipulated by scriptural language and things that are pulled out of context and used in either self-protective or hurtful ways to the people around them. And it's hard to call it out. Now I've got better at mind to say, whoa, what are you talking about here? I don't mind doing that. But I realize at younger ages, particularly, you just wouldn't know what to do. I would just sit there and go, oh my gosh, I think this guy's off his rocker, but what are you going to say? You hope he's genuine, then you find out later that they weren't, but what a nightmare. Well, and
again, like you said, it moves into that. As soon as you start to recognize that somebody is self-promoting or self-protecting, you know that something is going on around fear and shame. And so it is not a healthy or wholehearted space that person is operating out of at that time.
It's not, but wholehearted people seem to me to first think, maybe I'm doing something wrong. Maybe I'm missing something here. And so they kind of let it go let people get away with it because they're afraid, you know, who am I to confront and who am I to question it? And maybe I'm just in a space that's not healthy. And boy, we so many ways excuse what's going on when what's going on is not healthy.
The one that gets me the most is that God told me that I need to break up with you because I need to work on myself and I need to spend time with him. And then within less than a month, they're dating somebody else. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Unless like God put your self-discovery and self-work on hyperdrive, the thought that you ended the relationship with somebody, said that God told you to do it because you needed to work on yourself for a little while and spend more time with him. And then within 2 or 3 weeks, you're dating somebody else. Like, okay. Jeez.
Maybe all they needed was a month to be with Jesus.
I guess. I mean, the Holy Spirit works in miraculous ways, I guess.
Or somebody says, I know this seems cruel, but God told me I need to do this to you.
Oh,
when they're lying and betrayal or contacting lawyers to make lawsuits. How sad.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, before we got into patriarchy, we had had a podcast about thirsting, about desire, about that inner well, and got a lot of responses. We haven't been able to get back to it yet. So let me read some of those. Sue on the blog put this. Thanks, Kyle and Wayne, for this topic. Would love to hear you discuss this further. Exploring our passionate thirst, how the mistake is to fill up on cheap trinkets rather than seeing the love of God satisfy. And I have loved that about not only the book I'm reading on thirsting. Yeah. I've got more to say about that book at some point. But it really does just recognize when I'm frustrated about a desire I can't fulfill, to realize the desire is not for that thing.
Yeah.
It's displaced to that thing. And even the prayer that says, okay, I know I don't want you. I know what I want is love.
Yeah.
And how do I find my way to that? But that's the deep seed need. I was talking to somebody this week dealing with loneliness, deep loneliness, for person and people companionship. And we got to talk about, do you think that's displaced from something else? And do you think we can say to that loneliness, it's not really you. You're not my problem.
Yeah.
There's a hunger in my being that is crying out for a connection with God that is not being filled at the moment. And because it's not, I'm trying to find it in people, or I'm trying to find it in my job, or I'm trying to find it in my amusements. And it really is wonderful when you realize there's a desire deeper in all of us than the externals that we're often looking at.
Yeah, I think that comes back to your best thing that you heard this week, because I think often we race into the emotion, or we let the emotion go unchecked without pausing and holding space and saying, okay, Lord, what's authoring this? Because I also know people who feel like they have a pretty good relationship with Christ, that in that space they're doing well, but really are hungering for shared community. So people that I can do this life with, people that I can have those conversations with, people that I can explore what God's up to in my life and in my world, and to do that in a way that is safe and unchecked and is well received and well held. I love the idea of it being, of emotion being a messenger, and really highlighting, okay, what's going on in my inner world? What is being highlighted here? And that, man, I think so often there's a desire that gets brought to the surface. So we put language around a desire. We put language around something of like, okay, I want a marriage, or I want a good friend, or I want a good job, or I want a bigger house, or, you know, whatever that desire, that longing might be. And to pause and say, okay, Lord, what's catalyzing that? Is it just like genuinely because we don't have a whole lot of space in our house and we want to have a little more space? Okay, that's fine, you know. But is there something more that's causing that to move into your world, into your consciousness, onto your radar? And Father, if so, then what is it that you have up your sleeve there? What are you wanting to do with that? Because I think that so often, at least for me anyway, and I would love your thoughts on this. Initially, in what I was taught was you kill desire. You don't allow desire to, you don't give desire any space in your world, Because if you do, then that desire will lead you astray. It'll lead you into all the temptations and the darkness of your heart and all these things. It'll lead you into the weeds and you'll never come back. And so avoid it, like kill it, do whatever you need to do to it, but do not allow desire to have a hold in your life. And I don't know about you, I'm not very good at killing desire. And I tried fairly, I tried pretty hard. I gave it a good college try, and it still seeped through the different cracks and spaces in the walls that I tried to build around it and tried to close it off, or things that I tried to do to strangle desire. And yet desire kept popping up and resurfacing, and I think in a very gracious, God-filled way. But what do you think about that?
I think the whole response to desire being a negative thing, and we've got to quash it and press it down and ignore it and walk, you know, all that, that it's anti-godliness to have desires, is just wrong. And yeah. I love what Toby adds to Just Love, where there's a whole chapter on desire, and God's given us desire, and desire is not a bad thing. The word lust that we use in scripture, just the word for desire. So in a religious construct, we often make lust or desire wrong, evil, got to be satisfied with what God's given me, you know, what's in my life right now, and all those kinds of things, instead of taking my desires. And some of those, I think the real dangerous desires that we do as humans, and I got this from when we were reading through, when I was reading through the, man slips my name at the moment, Dante's Inferno.
Oh, yeah.
Or Dante's, Inferno was only the first part of it. But the whole idea, what sin is, sin takes a desire, idealizes it in the way I should have it, and then sends me into this frustration of not being able to achieve it, whether that's, you know, and that can be for legitimate things like community, like a spouse, like whatever. I tend to do this. I tend to idealize my desires and play with that, live in that. And then nothing ever happens that gets to the height of that ideal. But I find that God has ways, like I've said before, most of the visions I had as a young man have not come to pass in my life. But the things that have come to pass are greater than the visions I had. So I've learned to trust that God knows best. And I don't, to me, it's not squishing desire, but it is really allowing, finding what is God's desires? Where does my desire really go to that's healthy and wonderful and is part of my growth experience and being hungering and thirsting and seeing God fill those desires? But I think we have to take them pretty honestly head on and not just say all desires bad to kill them. But okay, where are my desires? Are they, are this idealized something that's never going to happen? Then I need to figure out how Jesus helps me let go of that. But what do I really desire beneath the thing that I think I want to kind of fill an empty place in my life is very different from the real desires God's given me to help me find the direction. It's like finding that pearl of great price, which is, I mean, that's a desire. I've found something so rich, so real, you'd sell everything you have to have it. There's desires in my life like that right now that God fulfills that are beautiful. But even you mentioned the desire for community, because that's a God-given desire. That's a godly thing. But once we idealize it to something that doesn't exist on the planet, is a problem. Or we look for it in a group and then we can't find that group. If we look at it as a desire for connection, and then the prayer becomes, so God, who are you connecting me to today? Where, who are you putting in my life? And then let those connections grow, find friendship with people you connect with. Don't start a Bible study. Don't just find friendship, connection, love, support, kindness, grace, and watch what happens from there. Because community, I think, is more real than I found my people and we meet together every week. And, but we don't, how many of those groups have I met with that we didn't have real friendships outside of the group? We just had a group meeting. And the idea is to have friendships, people you can walk with, people who are there when you hurt, and people who hold what you share in trust, and they don't use it to wedge something against you later or to hurt you or to gossip about you. They're really able to just hold your weaknesses as well as your strength. If you don't have relationships like that, that's a godly thing. I'd be talking to God about that. How do you bring those to pass in my life? But if I think it's my responsibility and I've got to go find it on my own, that's where we're going to make the mistakes.
Well, and I think that's the other piece too, that I really want to circle back to in regards to this conversation about desire is trusting God to bring us those desires of our heart and what that looks like. Because I remember, so 2013, I had been given a offer of a professorship at a college in Southern California and had to walk away from it when Jess and I made the decision to move to Wyoming and to pursue something, to pursue some better health for her and some other different things that God was doing. And that was really hard for me because I knew that I wanted to be a teacher. I knew that I loved creating those type of lived experiences for students. I knew that that was something that put a huge passion in my heart that just fired me up every time I got the opportunity to do it. But a decade later, now I'm doing it. Now I'm back and I'm circled back to it. I have the opportunity to be a professor again, but I'm so much better of a professor because I have over a decade of lived experience working in mental health. And so now the level of context and experience and perspective that I can bring to my students is so much more informed than what I would have been able to offer to my students back in Southern California. And so I think that's the other piece too is, okay, Lord, I have this desire that's on my heart. I have this longing, this aching that's there. If you are the one authoring this, Lord, I want you to be the one to also build it. Show me what that looks like. I want to hold this lightly and see what it is that you do with it. Because I think both you and I can strongly attest to we held desires in the palm of our hand early on, even early on as young men, and said, Lord, I feel like you're doing something here in my heart. I feel like you're bringing up something, you're stirring something, you're highlighting a piece of who you've made me to be. But what does it look like to live that out of your direction, your spirit, your training, your guidance versus, oh, I've got language around this. Now I'm going to go make it happen to my own strength and say, okay, thanks God for showing me that. Peace out. I'm out. I'm going to go do this on my own. Like that, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. And I think it probably feeds right back into Esther's statement. Again, we could say my desires are a messenger, not a master.
Yeah.
And if we could have that philosophy about it, but desire is not a bad thing. Desire is a good thing. And desires, if we can find God's way of fulfilling them, rather than resorting to our own thing. Harvey wrote this by email. I said, you and Kyle talk so much about the ache of having again the emotional joy of knowing Jesus like you did at the start, or those special times with him in the past. And the focus of that desire is to be with Jesus again. I don't think my sense of desire was that, like trying to recover some emotional experience from the past, because I think that's a trap, quite honestly, because God's so unique in the way he touches us that what I'm looking for today is for God's touch in my life. I'm not looking like it to look like what it was before. In fact, it's probably not going to look like what it was before. But anyway, I understand. He said, the ache in my heart is a little bit different, and it was going around in my head through most of the podcast. I got separated from my wife of 36 years, and I never stopped loving her. She's remarried now, and I have no contact with her. So I feel like the ache I have in my heart was connected to the ache in Jesus's heart for his bride. I feel that ache with him. So if I can say it this way, my ache is not just to be with him alone, but I want him to have what he wants and to be a part of that. And that is to return all the way back to the most beautiful bride the universe has ever seen that was born on the day of Pentecost. So I know most certainly that I will not be satisfied until he has the answer to his prayer to his father that they may be one, even as we are one. Hmm. Which is a good way to see that desire, that ache. I mean, my heart goes out to him, man, lost his wife at 36 and still in love with her. After 36 years of marriage, lost his wife. She's remarried. He still aches for her. But now taking that ache inside of Jesus' ache for his bride, particularly the waywardness of his bride and wanting her to come back. And I think that's a good way to handle a desire like that. That's you can't have it again, the desire you had, but you can let it be shaped inside God's desire for something greater and that you're part of that as well.
The other piece, and this is, I'd love your feedback on this as well, because I think the other interesting challenge, and this has been an ongoing dialogue between me and Father a lot, is at times there's desire. I feel like God is moving or doing something and that he is in it. And yet there is multiple people who are involved with that and they all have free will and they all have the ability to say yes or no. And so sometimes I see like something moving and it's awesome and there's desire there. And I feel like, yes, God is in this. And then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, one or more of the people that are a part of that are not in the same place, not in alignment with that, not in agreement with that, whatever that might be.
Or they might have started in agreement with that and then checked out as things were starting to come together. Yeah.
And so I think that's the other intriguing part. And this is, I think this is the ache that Father, I don't know. I have no idea. I'm still trying to sort this out with God, but I think there's a holding of sorrow when there's something that God's wanting to do. He invites his bride to be a part of creating it. And then for whatever reason, it gets derailed and it doesn't happen in, let's say, necessarily the way that he had initially envisioned, God had initially envisioned it happening. And yet his defense of free will is very intriguing to me because it's like, no, like, what was it? You made the comment a while ago to me, something along the line, we were talking about obedience and trust and faith. And there was that comment, you made a comment about how, Kyle, like, God has been inviting you multiple times to say yes to this. And you said yes for the first time in 10 invitations, and that brought delight to, like, but he hasn't stopped inviting you into more things, right? Like, right. His desire is still to do relationship with me, whether I say yes to it or not. He keeps coming back with that desire. He keeps opening up that door. And that's really intriguing to me, is like, okay, Lord, how do we navigate that design, desire, your will being expressed in the world, but then also the free will that people have and how they may join in with and participate in the manifestation of that desire or that kingdom outpouring or that kingdom idea. And then other times they might say, no, I'm not into that. Like, even thinking about the dating relationships and how, like, talking to people and they're like, I really felt like this was the partner that God gave me to be with. And yet that person did not express any love towards them, or initially did and then left, or whatever that might look like. And it's like, Lord, what do we do with that desire? What do I do with that longing? Just like the email that you read with Harvey. What do we do, Lord? How do you meet the desire under the desire that may have not been met, or that may have been thwarted, or that may have fallen apart? Like, I think of even like John Eldridge, and when he was writing The Journey of Desire, and he was talking about how he had this dream of doing these men's retreats and stuff, and he was wanting to do it with his best friend. And within like the first year, not even first year of them living this dream, this desire, this reality, his best friend gets killed in a climbing accident. And he's like, Lord, that was the person that I wanted to do this with. Like, that was the person we dreamt about this. We planned this. We brought this into alignment. We pursue this. And then within less than a year of us launching this ministry, he dies in a climbing accident, but beside me, gets killed. They were climbing together and he dies. Like, what the heck, Lord? Like, what do we do with that, Father? So what are your thoughts on that? I'm really intrigued. I just went on a rant.
Yeah, you did. When I was thinking, when you were talking initially, I was thinking about my years pastoring. Mm. We really feel like God sets a vision before us and we start down that road, and then something gets sidetracked and people can't quite live out the commitment that gets to point B. And then, so you're frustrated and you're trying to get people, trying to prop them up and encourage them down the road and trying to get, or if it's the dating relationship, the gal you really want and she's not responding and you're trying to really encourage it in every way you can. What I've learned in the last 30 years without living in that environment where my fullness depends on how someone else's responds, what God, I think, encourages too, if we find our fullness to that well of desire that's in each of us, if I find it in him, and I think it's down this road, that road can get sidetracked. You know, I think the Shack got sidetracked from what that team of people could have done and been, and what we talked about, the three of us, and dreamed together. And it got sidetracked by other people who wanted to own a piece of the action, who didn't understand the action, just wanted, they saw dollar signs, and that just put them in a different place. So I have been part of many aborted realities of things I thought God was doing that because of the response of other people didn't get there. And yet I'm still dumb enough to do it. I'm still dumb enough to like write a book with Toby. I've never met the man face to face. I won't meet him face to face until we're in Kansas City next month. So I still go down the road of saying, okay, I think God has something here. So let's go down that road. And I realize whether it's my co-pastor, whether it's the Shack, whether it's where most things in my life that start out wonderful and beautiful and accomplish some amazing things get sidetracked by different realities. Hmm. And I've learned to be okay with that. I've learned to ride this horse as long as this horse seems to express what God's about. And when it doesn't, I'm not married to the horse. So, you know, when some of those things start to go away, it's like, it's not that they didn't hurt. They hurt deeply.
Yeah.
But you step back and you go, okay, God, what do you have now? And to me, that's where fullness has got to arise from. It's not from the outcome. If it's ever from the outcome I desire, I will manipulate people. Even with the best of intentions, I will manipulate people because so committed to God wants this to happen and we've got to do whatever it takes to get there. But I realize, man, it doesn't matter what happens. It doesn't matter if your greatest desire goes away. There's a way for God to inhabit that space. And when he inhabits the fullness from the inside, that can still live out. And I risked that 4 years ago with Sarah being gone. And it was,
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah. It was like, okay, this is the biggest way that could happen. And I hope
you were married to,
I hope. Yes. I married that horse. No, don't mean that, baby. But I meant the marriage, not the person. But yeah, and could that side, this man lost his wife after 36 years and it was like one checked out and one didn't. And that happens a lot. But is God still bigger than that? If we're connected to outcomes, I think life in an age of chaos can be incredibly frustrating. Hmm. If our hope is not in outcomes, I mean, Jesus had a great friendship with Peter, James, and John. And the night on his life when he needed them the most, they couldn't be there for him.
Yeah.
And he didn't punish them for it. He didn't get angry at them. He just realized, okay, they're not there, but my hope is in my Father's work in me. My hope is not in that person shares it with me in the way I hope they do. Hmm. I love the fact that there's endless ways God does what God does. Yeah. And if we don't get lost in the idealized outcome we want, then we're going to see where else that flows to. My life has been a constant hopeful, something really wonderful is going to happen here, to get sidetracked, to seeing God open another door and something else happening that was extraordinary. And then that may get closed, but it keeps the adventure. That's why I think when Esther says, I wake up every morning, I go to bed every night excited to see what Father might reveal in my dreams, and wake up every morning and look forward to the adventure with the Trinity. That's how I live my life. The excitement is the adventure with the Trinity. It's not the outcome I want.
Yeah.
But that's hard. That there's 40 years of growing there with incredible, great, great disappointment and great anguish and great pain. And then finding the way to fullness again and realize fullness is bigger than the outcome I want. Joy and contentment is bigger than that.
Yeah, I think it really comes back down, at least where I've taken things when I've had those unmet desires or those derailed desires, is Father, you are the author of the desire. You are the one that's going to have to hold this. You are going to have to be the one that repairs this, because if I tried to do it in my own strength, I would manipulate. I would, I would venture into a lot of places that are incredibly unhealthy for me and all parties involved. And so, Father, what does it look like for you to maintain or meet that desire, realign that desire, reconnect me with that desire down the road, whatever that looks like. Because I mean, even thinking about Job, right? I mean, he had family, he had all this wealth, he had all these different things, all of it was wiped out. And yet God was able to return it in different ways and in more fold. And I like, if there's like, I'm looking forward to, if the personhood of Job wasn't an allegory, I'm looking forward to meeting the person of Job and saying, so how did God restore that? Was it exactly the same amount, or did he do it in a different way? Did he come through a perspective or a side route that, like, we hear your story, but what was the lived reality details? Like, how did you manage your heart in the midst of that? Yeah.
Yeah, when you say God is the author of our desire, what I'd want to clarify is God is the author of the real desire underlining our life.
Yes.
May
yes,
not be you. The author of the desire we clothed it in to make me happy.
Yes,
exactly. And that to me, when that gets exposed for me, when, oh, so that was my desire attached. Yeah. If we can dig down to the deeper desire and then go, okay, that doesn't get sidetracked.
Yes.
The external thing, Matt, that doesn't. Allison wrote this. I know we're running out of time. It says, thanks so much, you and Kyle, for this episode, Resilient One on Thirsting. It's speaking directly to where I'm at right now. You said maybe you should devote a few episodes on how to help people create the environment in their heart to host the God who is already there. My response is yes, please. And Sue had asked for the same thing. Maybe we could have some time to explore. Would love to hear you discuss this further, exploring our passionate thirst and the mistake we make to fill up on cheap trinkets. So that's what I'd love for us to do. I'd love for us to take an episode or two and really help people explore, where is that deep hunger? If I've lost touch with it, how do I find it? If I feel like I'm in touch with it, but it remains unfulfilled, what do I do about that? I think it'd be, I love the way Allison expressed it. She said, help people create the environment in the heart to host the God who is already there. I think we'll think about that. Putting people in touch with that, to me, is just the greatest gift you can give someone, is how to be full on the, how to let that deep aquifer of desire for God find its home in him, and then live out of that as circumstances come at you in chaotic ways, which they always do.
Always.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.